Let's do a podcast.
Let's do a podcast.
It's Dubber and Steve again. And we're going to talk today about money.
Yeah, money.
Because we've both got some recently. We've both come into tremendous riches.
We have. We're both 100 heirs, I think, as a result, which is kind of exciting. What was the working title for the last album, actually, for 11 reasons? The working title was, by this time next year, we'll both be 100 heirs. I've just released a new album called Believe in Peace, and
I've just released a work in progress book called Music in the Digital Age, which is about all this sort of stuff.
And we've both had some interesting conversations about what we're doing with people who have interesting questions to ask. I had a comment this morning on a forum where someone said, "Is this a real album? Can I get it on CD?" To which the answer was, "Yes, it's real. No, you can't get it on CD." Which I think probably baffled the person somewhat, because the two questions were meant to be linked. And you've had some interesting correspondence too, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been interesting because, first of all, just sort of making the explanation that this is not a finished book that I'm selling, that this is a book in progress, and here's, you know, a good few chapters of it. But apart from anything else, paying me for it is an incredible incentive for me to, A, finish it, and B, make it really, really good. So this is something that I've committed to for this year, and it's a work in progress. So it will be for sale all the way along. But the other conversation I've had has been about what price should it be? And the kind of the two poles of that, one is, well, if it's not a finished book, how can you charge anything at all for it? And the other one is, if you're writing a book, what are you doing giving it away for free? And so between those two places is somewhere I feel comfortable. And what I've ended up with is it is available for free. You can pay whatever you want for it, including free. But the interesting thing about LeanPub, which is the organization I'm using to work it out, is they have this idea of the recommended price. Mm. And I set the recommended price originally at $5, which seems, you know, I mean, that people have been sort of describing that being like a beer or a, you know, Starbucks, you know, what's the big, the venti Starbucks.
The buckets.
Yeah, exactly. And people kind of think, well, that's what they're buying me. They're buying me a large cup of coffee or a beer or whatever it might be. But then I thought, well, if it's only a recommended price, it's actually completely arbitrary because you can type in whatever numbers you want. So I put $7.99 because that seems to be what sort of, you know, cheap books cost. Yeah, yeah. And suddenly people stopped paying. There was something in that, I think. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a completely scientific survey of any kind, but people were still downloading it at the same rate of knots, but they were putting zero in rather than putting in a lesser number than $7.99. As soon as I put it back to $5, they were paying $5. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, I had an equally interesting split, which was that the first day of release of Believe in Peace, which was the 2nd of January, almost everybody who got it directly through hearing it about it from me. It was Twitter and Facebook. There was some people were talking about it, but I recognised most of the names that were coming through on the Bandcamp cha-ching emails. And those people were paying, and they were paying in an incredibly generous way, far more than someone would pay for, that I would ever pay for a CD. And so they were paying it out of something else.
Because they like you?
Well, I think there was a couple of things. One of which was they like. The other is that a third of the money on it is going to Reprieve, who are a human rights charity. They are legally active on behalf of the people who still left in Guantanamo Bay, and they campaign against the death penalty and campaign for the legal human rights of people to be upheld.
Yeah, the goodies, in other words.
They're fabulous people. So a third of all the money that I make off it is going to them. So I think that is part of the story as well. But a very interesting thing happened the next day, which was that the friends of mine who were hearing about it and the people or people that I knew on some level that were connected with me continued to buy it. But a couple of reviews came out, a couple of kind of things on, just little things on base websites and forums and stuff. And all of a sudden, the rate of free downloading of the people who would, because the option on Bandcamp that I used consistently for however long is for people to pay whatever they think it's worth or whatever they can afford, or somewhere between the two. And so the you can put a zero in and you download it for free. And so that rate went up. The percent, the ratio of people who paid, didn't pay for it went up when the people downloading it didn't know me. And I found that very interesting for a number of reasons. One of which is obviously the conversation about the value of the relationship, of people's sense of investment in me. The point that you said, people like me and are therefore they want me to make more music. And if someone's just discovered me, worrying about what I do in the future is not part of the equation. The relationship is actually about, it's a discovery one to do with the music itself. They might have been drawn there by something interesting that someone's written about it. It might be because of how they value the person that recommended it. Some very nice people have been saying very nice things about it. But actually, at that point, they don't have much of an investment in me. So the option to get it for free is one where they can, it's a very low risk kind of discovery process for them. They can download it so they don't just have to listen to it on the web. It's sort of friendly. But they are at a position where they can then choose to form a relationship with me. They listen to it, they go, wow, this is really interesting, or that's okay, I'm happy to listen to it once and delete it. But if they do find it particularly fascinating, there's enough of me on the internet, all 18,000 pages of me or whatever there is on there, that they can go and find out about. And I found that really interesting. But they're also less likely to have read about the charity aspect, because they'll have gone straight into the site and probably hit play and then gone, oh, yeah, that's interesting enough to download and listen to later. But the reason, the interesting thing about this for me is the fact that we are able to mess with this stuff purely because these are digital entities that cost us nothing to for the copy to exist. That what people are downloading isn't my music, it's a recording of my music. And that those recordings can be replicated infinitely. And if someone said to me, here's an infinite supply of CDs, at that point I would stop worrying about how people got hold of them. I would be out on the streets dishing them out, knowing that I could come home and pick up another box and go and give them until everybody in the world had one. I would be out on the streets, I would have bags full of them. And they said, it's okay, you're never going to have to pay for these CDs. For as long as you want, you can go out and get, and I'd be, this is brilliant, this is the best promo material ever. Because previously, we paid for them to be on the covers of magazines.
Yeah, well, see, this is one of the interesting things. There was a blog post that was put up that said, this guy's written this book and it's out and isn't that interesting, and it's, you know, a partial book and you can go and download it. And somebody commented on it saying, look, I've downloaded it and I've been through it, and there's not much of a book there to start with, and it's, you know, etc. But one of the points that he said was, this guy's a sound engineer, works in a recording studio or runs a recording studio, said, I recorded an album for a band for an absolute rock bottom $6,000. And if your recommendations, because I talk about pricing in the book, and I talk about this idea of $5 being this kind of magic number almost. And he said, if, on that basis, X number of people would need to buy it for it to have been worthwhile. I said, and the question was, should people be gambling on that basis? And I thought, well, it's not gambling if you know how much it costs to record something. But the point is, nobody has to record an album. This 6,000, nobody has to spend that $6,000. If you look at it and go, well, we might sell 100 copies, how much would we need to charge? We'd have to charge, you know, £60 per album in order to even just recoup what we spent in the studio. Is recording an album really a good idea in those circumstances? Or are there other things we could do? Or is there another way we could do
this? Well, this is a conversation that often gets hijacked by people whose bottom line seems to be, I want to do things the way I read about other people doing them in the past. And if I can't do that, then the system is broken. And so instead of I mean, it's not even a question of what people did in the past. It's what they'd read about what people did in the past. And as I've said a few times recently, in all cases, history is written by the winners. In the music industry, it's written by lottery winners. And so you have this handful of people who are written about in books who continue to peddle their own myth in order to try and sell more. It's amazing how far someone has to be removed from the music industry before they're willing to be honest about it from that old position. It's normally people who've given up music altogether and have something else. So you meet someone like Tom Robinson, whose income stream now is radio, and is one of the most fantastic champions of new music in the country. I think he's, you know, just his energy and that is great. But he will be honest about, you know, how dark it was for him at times because he's not reliant on making money off his back catalogue. But a lot of people in his position are, and they at least they still hope to make money off it. So they don't want to burn those bridges, even though the bridges are kind of pretty rickety and falling apart anyway.
Mm.
So what's I think is sadder than those people, because they had their shot at it and they ought to know better, is the younger people whose assumption is that, you know, this idea of the rock bottom $6,000. You say, well, rock bottom for what? What are you doing? Why have you suggested that making a record that where you have no, there's no reasonable assumption that you should be able to make back $6,000 on anything. I mean, your statement that you've always made is you know, you don't have a right to make money out of music, you have an opportunity.
Mm.
And the notion that you would work to a budget that is based on a reasonable expectation of what you could make back is you know, that suddenly says, you, at that point you go, well, $6,000 for a band that no one's actually heard of yet, that seems wholly unreasonable. I need to sell basically 1,000 CDs to make that back.
Mm.
1,000 CDs at shop price, which, you know, if I'm not making 10 quid per CD. In order to do that and to send those out, I need to sell 1,000 of those at that, which means I need to press way more than 1,000 because of all the promo involved. So either someone has to front the $6,000 and be willing to lose it, or the $6,000 figure has to disappear. And you go, okay, what else can we do? Why is $6,000 the rock bottom price? And I had this conversation on Twitter the other day about the cost of recording, and people were telling me that, because I said to George Monbiot, actually, we were talking about that. I said that because he was talking about, he made an allusion to the idea that music is sort of getting harder and harder. And I said, no, it's getting easier, because the headline figure is that music sales has dropped by 30 or 40%, but the cost of making music has dropped by 90%. That doesn't mean that people are spending 90% less than they used to. It's just that they could if they were smart about it.
Yeah, I mean, I have some sympathy. I mean, I'm a former sound engineer and record producer, and I love the studio, and I love the what it allows you to do, and you know, the quality. And I mean, not everybody is a solo bass player. Some people have to record drums. Some people have to have choirs. Some people have visions in which there are entire string sections. So some things do cost money, I think, to make.
Yeah.
But at the same time, by the same token, this is not a necessity. You don't have to do that. And if the only reason for you to make that record is because that's how you want to make your living, and making that record is not good business, then you shouldn't make that record. However, if you've got other reasons for making that record, then you might be able to justify it on another basis. And I think, and the idea that the only reason anybody makes a record is because they think they can make a profit at it is nonsense. There is more to it than that. And I thought that that's kind of worth saying, that if you think it's worthwhile for you, for all manner of reasons, to spend £6,000 in a recording studio, knock yourself out.
Well, see,
but it's nobody else's job to make sure that you get that money back.
But if you've got £6,000, you can go so much further by spending it wisely. And that one of the big issues of what people do is, you mentioned that drums are very expensive to record, and they can be. But with that £6,000, you could buy the most fantastic mobile recording unit. And you can be really, there are so many interesting ways of going out and finding good spaces to record in. There are old buildings.
I know this is not what we wanted to talk about, but I do want to wave a flag for a trained set of ears who knows what they're doing, that understands how sound works, knows where to point microphones. I mean, having the gear is one thing, but having the expertise that is required to make it sound good is another.
But that expertise, again, is available in lots of different forms. And I think that this is the problem. It's this idea that it's a bit like when we talk about what late record labels used to do. There are very few of the jobs that record labels used to do that are now completely obsolete.
Mm.
It's just the idea that they come as a package that's nonsense. So you can pick and choose all those different elements, and you get good people to do them. And you said these things cost money. I think they cost. I don't think they have to cost money. I think that actually the way that musicians end up trading money amongst themselves, so it all looks like they've made more money, but they've just got it in and then paid it out to someone else. There are particular scenes where this is particularly problematic. The London jazz scene would be a perfect example. And because they don't actually have any other equitable way of doing that, and it makes them all feel better about the fact that, you know, I got paid 300 quid to do this session, and I paid him 150 quid to do that, so I'm net up 150 quid. You go, well, that's fine, but surely you'd have been better off to have six albums exist, and none of you have spent any money. But what I think is that the level of disruption that's possible in any particular process changes depending on who it is.
Mm.
I've heard single people record entire string sections by being really, really good at playing violin, viola, and then getting a cellist in to do the parts on that.
Yeah.
I've heard, the best drum sound I've ever recorded was recorded in a 14th century farmhouse in Italy with a crossed pair of mics that cost 200 quid on eBay because someone bought a pair of Octavas and got lucky because the quality control was ridiculous. But the point being that's not always possible, but something else is. And I think your point about the big vision not being the kind of main objective at this stage, I think what I think is exciting is that you can build up to it. And the fact that you can release music at zero cost, that you can record a voice and a guitar at zero cost. So you get the singer to sit down with and sing and play guitar or play piano and do an acoustic version of the songs. And you put it out dirt cheap and you say, this is what we're working on.
Mm.
We're going to do one song live with the whole kind of cleverness. We're going to film it. We're going to put it out there. It's funny how people are innovating like this in so many different areas. I think what you're doing with a half-finished book is really good because it's not Kickstarter. It's more grassroots than that. You're not promising any big vision. You're saying this is a writing project and you can be a part of it and you don't have to be. And you can be a part of it by downloading it or you can be a part of it by investing in it. And I like the grown-upness of that. Another example from a different industry is what Mike Sizemore and Sleepy Dog did with Slingers.
Mm.
Where what's normal for Mike has written a TV series called Slingers, and I think he's got the ideas for about three or four seasons of it, and the vision for it grew and grew and grew as they were working on it. Put Slingers into YouTube, and you can see that.
But this is like high production value science fiction, yeah. And you know, really high concept, big name actors,
absolutely massive stuff. This is not people messing around in their back bedroom. This is really, really big stuff.
Typing about music on the internet.
Yeah. This is Oscar-winning directors and you know, actors you've heard of. But what they did was that they said, okay, well, our level of disruption is going to be different to everyone else. We're not trying to do this at zero cost, but we're trying to make it cost thousands rather than millions. And so instead of recording a pilot episode and cutting a sizzle reel from that, a sizzle reel is the thing you take around to funders in order to try and get them to kind of, you know, watch 3 minutes of it and decide they like it. They recorded the sizzle, and they wrote it and filmed it as a sort of 3 or 4 minute short, and put it on the internet, and created this massive buzz. 30,000 people watched it in a day, and you had very, very well known sci-fi writers going, "This is going to be brilliant. You need to back this." They generated an enormous amount of energy in a way that nobody had done before in that industry. Yes, it still cost thousands, but they were talking about making a TV series. This isn't a high school project. This is people with the money to invest in making a TV series. But what they did was they saw the potential in digital distribution to cut out an enormous amount of those costs. It cost probably one-tenth of what it would have cost to do it the other way. And they had the big story of the fact that they were doing it like that. They got all these actors on board because the actors needed to commit to a much smaller level of stuff because it was, you know, come in and film for 3 minutes or 3 minutes of stuff. It wasn't only on set for 3 minutes. But it meant they could write better. The production value in the sizzle itself was fantastic because all the CGI only needed to be for 3 minutes, not a whole thing that was then cut. And so for me, the lesson from that as an artist is that I, as a musician, could do an enormous number of things. If someone came to me and gave me 50 grand and said, "I want you to go and make music with this," I'm not going to make a bunch of solo bass records. I love playing solo, and then a huge part of my musical vision is about that set of limitations. But there are loads of other things that I can do. It's not a fetish. It's not like I have to play solo. I'd love to do something for bass and strings. I'd love to work with an orchestra. I'd love to write for three horns and a choir.
Yeah, but you're not going to go and get a bank loan, get the strings together, record it, spend the money, and then go, "Where's this going to come from? How much am I going to charge for my album so that I can recoup my costs?"
Yeah, because all of those things...
That's back to front.
Yeah, because A, they don't need to exist, and B, even if they do, they don't need to exist now. So I have 10 years, I have 20 years, I have 30 years of career left. I'm 39 now. As a kind of jazz, contemporary, classical, blah, blah, musician, whatever it is, non-pop musician, I'm still a kid. You know, the people who are doing interesting things in my field are all 10, 20, 30 years older than me. I'm still very young. My solo career is about 12 years. I'm about 12 years into it. That's a very short amount of time in those kind of terms.
I could say the same thing about me as a writer. You know?
Yeah.
All the smart people are 20 years older than me.
Everything's developmental. Everything's a beta project. Everything is about moving forward. And the great thing about putting music out there is that each of those things become benchmarks in your journey. That rather than me thinking of it as a product that requires investment and recoupment, it's all part of the fun of the story. That there's a kind of meta story that all of these things are narrative elements within. And so I make a record, and it's not just about saying, here's a thing that I can sell. It's about saying, this is part of what I've done. And because of the web, I can make these things available in a format that is shareable and that other people can take and tell their own stories with. One of the reasons why I think this new record, Believe in Peace, has done so well in the last couple of days, because it's been my fastest selling kind of first couple of days of any digital release I've ever done. We're talking hundreds rather than thousands of pounds, but it's been really nice for it to do that. One of the reasons is that there was a backstory to it. It was recorded in an art gallery. It was inspired by an artist who's focusing on the theme of peace as found in the writing in the I Ching. There's artwork attached to it. There's a whole story. There was a tornado going on while I was recording it. That kind of stuff, that the music becomes the soundtrack to that concept, to that story. It's not just me going, here's a music that I think is great, and you might think it's great as well. There's nothing confrontational about it like that. I'm inviting people in, and they can engage with it however they want. On a commercial level, the shortest track on it is 9.5 minutes long. This is not radio fodder, well, at least not other than Lake Junction. God bless Fiona Talkington. This isn't daytime radio, but there's a story to it, and people can add their own stories to that. And that idea that what you're doing, even though you're writing nonfiction, is you're writing a story.
Hmm. Well, there's two stories that are coming back the other way that I'm kind of interested in. One of them is the story that I put on my personal blog today, which is the guy that said, you know, thanks for putting this up online. Thank you for making it available for free, because, you know, I'm a musician and I'm just about to have a new baby and we're just renovating the bathroom. And for the first time in my life, I'm absolutely skint, but I really want to read your book. I don't want to stop people like that from having access to this. So to me, the idea that you can have it for whatever you want to pay for it, including free, is really important. But I think there's also something about that sort of magic $5 or £3, if you like, number that goes with it as a suggestion of this is what seems right. If you want to pay for it, there's a good benchmark. I think that's a kind of an interesting place to be. But the other story that I wanted to tell was the one about, because Lean Pub, it's anonymous, you get to find out who has downloaded your, because they pay you directly from their PayPal account.
Yeah.
You get the email addresses, but it's completely anonymous. I don't know whether you paid me $0 or $10 or whatever. Yeah. So you don't have that kind of inbuilt. And I think there is a little bit of a potential guilt avoidance thing that goes along with Bandcamp that says, he's going to know what I paid for this.
Yeah.
Now, with my book, that's not the case. You can pay $0 and then send me an email saying, I just got your book, I paid $10. And I will find that believable because that's entirely believable. But actually what's interesting is that people, because of that, and because people realize that what they're doing is they're paying Lean Pub, and in 3 months' time, Lean Pub will eventually sort of collect it up and give it to me. They are saying, but I want you to know what I paid for it because that's important to me that I value your work. So people are emailing me and saying, thanks very much for the book. I paid $5 for it.
Mm.
And they're emailing me to say, thanks very much for the book. I didn't pay anything for it.
Yeah.
So that kind of, that communication that you get, which is kind of an unexpected thing for me. I wasn't anticipating that people would want me to know when they had or hadn't paid a particular amount of money for it.
I've had so many of those kind of conversations over the years, and it's always been with intangible things. I've had students who've refused to pay me my teaching rate and have said, I want to pay you more because I think you're undervaluing yourself. And I've said, it's not that I'm undervaluing it, it's just that I'm willing to work for the amount that I think people can afford. Ideally, I'd charge everyone 1/1000th of their annual salary. And I'd say, okay, if you earn 15 grand a year, okay, pay me 15 quid an hour, that's fine. If you earn 100 grand a year, yeah, you should be paying me 100 quid an hour because this is, you know, I'm good at what I do. But I'd much rather that it was somehow,
you know, proportionate.
Yeah. But I have the same kind of conversations, and one I had the other day was someone who emailed me and said, "Oh, I haven't got any money at the moment, but I'll just listen on Bandcamp and I'll buy it next month." And I went, "You know what? just have it. You know, it really, if you want to buy something later on, that's fine. But in this case, it was someone who's been incredibly supportive of what I've done over the years.
Mm.
So I said, just have it, take it. It's a late Christmas present, it's yours. And the option to do that, that A, probably wouldn't come up with a CD because they wouldn't come to me and say, you know, because you don't tend to do that. They certainly, if it was in a shop, they wouldn't go to the guy in the shop and go, can you tell him, next time the artist comes in, can you let them know? When Miles Davis, oh, he's dead. Oh, no, I was just going to tell him that I'll pay for it next month. No, that's not going to happen. There's the fact that this narrative entity thing is that it becomes a conversational element. And that by putting it up there, I wrote a blog post yesterday about what I particularly like about Bandcamp and why I like it. And a word that keeps coming up in there is friendly. And I don't want what I do to be confrontational. I don't want there to be any kind of brinkmanship where I'm trying to set my price at the right level to try and get people to pay the most. Even if this resulted in me making less money, I wouldn't mind. It's a bit like the conversation we had about Spotify. It wasn't about me leaving Spotify. It wasn't about me making more money with or without it. It was about something bigger than that. And the whole project is bigger than that because art is bigger than that. I'm not a solo bassist because I think I'm going to make a career, you know, a full-time career out of it. I don't want to be full-time. I wouldn't want to spend 365 days a year doing this. I want to spend 365 days a year thinking about this. I want to make the time I spend actively doing it sustainable. I want it to pay for itself, and it does. And that's what's exciting. And people choosing to be a part of that is amazing. But that friendliness, that openness, that the fact that people can take it and download it. I'm sure there are a handful of people who go, duh, I got one over on him, idiot. I don't know. No one's ever going to tell me that.
Yeah. But that thing about friendliness is about context for me. It's about operating in spaces where you feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons I gave for bailing out of Facebook. It wasn't that I didn't like the people there. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy the conversations. I just felt like I was sitting in McDonald's. And I didn't want to. And so I took it elsewhere. But this idea of friendliness and it reminds me of this blog comment, the continuation of this other blog comment I was responding to. He basically summarized my point, saying, so to be a successful musician, you have to be a socially rounded, nice person too. The shape of play in film Amadeus was something about that, wasn't it? Which is obviously a very kind of sarcastic response. But my response to that is, I'd never seen the film, but I said, I kind of know the story. And if the film was in any way accurate, then Mozart and Salieri weren't getting cross-collateralized advances, making albums, sourcing remixes, shooting videos, doing live lounge sessions at Radio 1, in stores at HMV, DJ sets at Fabric, or playing the main stage at Glastonbury either. Quite a lot of other things have changed about what it is musicians do these days, and I'd venture that having conversations with other human beings without having to wait for the postman scarcely registers on the what's my job now scale. So it's not about you having to be a different person. Everything changes, and you have to understand what those changes are. And I mean, I'm trying to sell a book here. That's what the whole book is about. It's about understanding the changes so you can operate in a new environment.
I think it's also, and this is a conversation that I have a lot with people as well, which is that's all right for you. You're, you know, whichever particular personality trait I have that they're.
You're an ENFP, so
that kind of
type A or
yeah, you know what? The internet favors people like me. It really does. It's a space that I thrive in. But there's a lot of it that I wasn't comfortable with. There's a lot of it that I had to learn. There was a lot of graft that went into it. Because, A, learning things is good. Life being difficult is how we learn stuff. Life isn't meant to be simple. There's the idea that we should live this frictionless existence where everything is simple and we get paid to do that which we find easiest. It's ridiculous. It's not humanly beneficial, and no one expects that in any other area of work. Postmen don't go, but you're all right, you've got better legs than me, you're good at walking and shit. You know, they don't do that. They go, it's my job, I'm a postman, I'll do it, and if my legs hurt in the morning, then I'll try and get fitter.
Yeah, or I'll get another bike. But by the same token, it's not the internet's job to make you money out of your music. And I mean, the internet is a medium through which human beings communicate with each other. Having an internet strategy is like having a telephone strategy. It's not a platform within which music commerce exists. It's not a marketplace. Mm-hmm. It is just a communications technology. And it's really helpful for people who are really good at communicating. You know, like freedom of speech benefits the articulate. It's yeah. one of those things that just is part of
freedom of grunting.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's the problem. People go, well, how is the internet going to solve these problems for me? My answer is, that's not its job.
How is paper going to solve these problems?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes. What did the printing press ever do for ideas? Well, it just made them available. It didn't change them. And yeah, absolutely. And I think that for me, the big thing that has changed, and it's back to the very first point, is the fact that digital entities are ubiquitous. And so we can be far more experimental with them because I'm not spending 1,500 quid on pressing 1,000 CDs and commissioning artwork, and I'm not stuck with those at the end. That I have, that my new album, out there right now, there is a 1 in 6 trillion chance that there are a billion copies that I don't know about. That someone has taken it and it's just gone viral, and Obama tweeted about it but got my name wrong, so I didn't see it come up in the search term, and everybody's downloaded it and is loving it. And it wouldn't cost me anything for that to happen. It doesn't cost me anything for that to do. I can be way more experimental, way more friendly, way more open to the serendipity of other people taking it and doing interesting things with it. I have a number of friends who I know if they suddenly decide they like it and start going, you need to hear this, it could blow up, and I could suddenly, that those hundreds that I'm making at the moment of it could suddenly become thousands. Or it could be that because of that statistic of people not knowing me, not paying for it, I could end up with 10,000 listeners and no money.
Which is a good problem to have.
Fantastic problem to have. It's a thing I say a lot of the time. I'd love to have 10,000 listeners that I know about and not be earning from them, because at that point I go, great, how do I connect with them? Because if they're interested in what I'm doing, the likelihood is a percentage of them are going to be interested in me, and then we can start to have this conversation again. So I'm excited about it. I think that the economics of the web, which are multi-currency, it's not just money. There's all these other things that, back to the thing about, you know, things cost, but they don't necessarily cost money. And I think it's exciting, and I like the way things are going.
So the moral of the story is everything is lovely, and buy our stuff.
We're happy again.